Good evening. Apologize for the technical malfunctions earlier. It just happens when things get older, they run slower. Don't we know that personally? I know I don't seem to get things done as quickly as I used to, and I'm still a young whippersnapper. But old Faithful here, she's going to pull us through. This one's traveled halfway around the world with me and continue to work for me, but she's a little slow too, so hopefully she'll work as well this evening. We've been talking about the period of time between the Testaments, looking at the time from the close of the Old Testament during the days of the likes of Malachi and Nehemiah and Ezra, Daniel and others, as they closed out the final revelations of the Word of God. And the final empires that were ruling during that day and time, of course, Babylon ruling over the nation of Judah and covering a large area and then being overcome by the Medes and the Persians. And so when we look at these things, we want to keep some of these things in mind as we go through these things. As we noted in our lesson last week, we reminded ourselves of some of the things that were said there in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar during the days of Daniel, as Nebuchadnezzar had the dream and had a desire for it to be... Got to hook this up. I haven't used this one in so long. Oh well. He had this dream of this great image, and he had a desire for it to be told, first of all, what the dream was, and second of all, what it meant. And we noted that there was the head of gold, the arms and silver of the arms and chest area, shoulders of silver. The third kingdom, a kingdom of brass, which will bear rule over all the earth, and a fourth kingdom that's strong as iron. And as we've noted through history, we've noted the Babylonian Empire, the Medes and the Persians, and then finally last week we began looking at the Grecian Empire. And as we were looking at this, we noted that there was another dream there in the book of Daniel. There in Daniel chapter 8, as we looked at these things and saw how Daniel dreamed this dream here in Daniel chapter 8 of this great two-horned ram that was ruling and kind of prancing himself around, and then a shaggy he-goat comes up out of the west. This he-goat has one notable horn, and he comes across the earth so fast. He's pictured there in the dream as just floating above the ground, denoting the great speed with which he is going to go. And we noted that this was having reference to, let me just get through these, Alexander the Great as he was to take over the Medes and the Persians and destroy them. And as we looked at those things, we wanted to keep the things that the Bible has to say in mind. Because just keep in mind, these things are being prophesied around 550, 570, 580 B.C., these empires have not even been dreamed of. At the time that Daniel is prophesying of these things, there's no such thing as a Macedonian phalanx. There's no person such as Philip of Macedon. In fact, the Greeks are just some very small city-states over in their little tiny area of way off on the edge, away from the Babylonian Empire, when these things are being prophesied. Daniel is receiving this prophecy at the end of the Babylonian Empire, right before the Medes and the Persians are to rise up. And we noted in Daniel chapter 8, as we saw these things, that it foretold the coming of Alexander the Great. And we noted that when that large horn on the he-goat magnified itself, that it would break up and four horns would rise up in its place. And that's what we're going to look at this evening. We noted some things about Alexander the Great. He took control around 336 B.C., the son of Philip of Macedon, a military genius is really what his father was, and as smart as his father was, Alexander took the things that his father had done and made them better, made them work even better for him. And he was able to quickly go through and come against the Medes and the Persians. And we noted last week, as we looked at these things, that really he just kind of walked his way through the Persian Empire. He came across here at the Hellespont, fought the Persian army there at Granicus, fought them again here at Issus. He fought the main body there at Issus. And it was there that Darius left behind his wife and his mother and his children. And Alexander was very kind to them, as we noted. He went on down, laid siege against Tyre, and then laid a siege against Gaza. He came down, plotted out Alexandria there in the Nile River Delta, and then began his journey back over into the Persian Empire. He knew that as long as Darius was alive, as we mentioned last week, he was not successful. He finally fought him there at Gaugamela, and after the battle was victorious, he continued on. And over 13 years, he spent working his way throughout the Persian Empire, going beyond the Persian Empire, and carrying it on and pushing even further, going all the way to the Indus River. That's this river that's running right along through here. That's the edge of what we think of as modern-day India. He got to the edge of the Indus River, and his men essentially said, we're tired, and we want to go home. Once again, we look at the battle-hardened soldiers of our day, and they complain, and rightfully complain, about having to be overseas for 6 months, a year, 2 years. Rightfully they complain. They shouldn't have to be over there as long as they do. But just imagine being away from your family, being away from your home for 13 years. You're doing nothing but going from place to place, conquering, building cities, following this some would say, crazed lunatic as he fulfilled his supposed destiny and taking over the world. As those 13 years drug on, we can see that Alexander was a strange mixture of generosity and magnanimity and also unbelievable cruelty. We noted how when he captured Darius's wife and mother and children, he took great care of them. When Darius's wife died in childbirth, he gave her a royal burial. He continued to care for Darius's children. But we can also find that, especially as he grew later in life, that he was not exactly the best person to be around. He had a bodyguard that had been his bodyguard since he was a child, that he had put to death. And since the commander that he had put to along with the bodyguard, and since he was the son of a very important individual back in Macedon, he sent an envoy back to Macedon to have him put to death. He continued to do these things, and was towards the end of his life, he was drinking heavily. Other things kind of played a part, and then he finally came back to Babylon. Here in Babylon, he finally made his way back to Babylon after having increased the borders of the Grecian Empire and fighting as far as he could. He came back to Babylon and he died there in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler of Babylon, around June 10th or 11th, 323 BC. Now, before we move on and look at the things that occurred after his death, we want to keep in mind the idea that Alexander had was to spread the Grecian way of life. They thought the Hellenistic way of life was the best way to be. And so he began here, and his idea was to found cities like Alexandria and other places to show the world what Grecian culture was all about. They believed that the Grecian way of life, the Grecian way of thinking, was the best way. And so we find the Greek language being spread throughout this area. Another thing we want to keep in mind is that up until this time, all the powers, all of the empires we've been looking at, have been coming from the Mesopotamian River Valley. If you look over remember the Assyrian Empire, its capital was here at Nineveh, there on the Tigris River. That's the direction that it had come from. When it came from the east and traveled west. The Babylonian Empire, the capital there of Babylon, was there in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. Even the Medes and the Persians, their capitals at Susa, Ecbatana, and Persepolis were all east of the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley. This was where all the powers had come from. All the world empires had been from this area. And now we have power coming out of the west. And as it's coming through, it's spreading its way of life. It's spreading its language. Alexander was just 1 month shy of his 33rd birthday when he died. As we look at these things, to see all the work that had been done in those 13 years, and once again, we give Alexander a little bit more credit than we should. Yes, he drove his men to do these things, but it's because of the well-trained armies of his father that he was able to do all of these things. And so he's able to move the empire from Greece all the way over to the Indus River, all the way down into Egypt, and even overtake the Parthians. which was really quite a feat in and of itself, as we'll see as we continue looking at history in lessons to come. Now at his death, Alexander was survived by his mother Olympias, half-brother who was somewhat retarded, Philip, and his wife, and then also Alexander's wife, Roxana, and a son that was to be born after Alexander died. When Alexander died, his body was placed into a gold sarcophagus, which was then placed inside a gold casket. And the idea was to take care of it, and Ptolemy, who was one of his main generals, decided, well, whoever holds the body holds the empire, is the way some perceive it. And Ptolemy stole the body and carried it down to Memphis in Egypt. Whether he was just stealing the body or just putting it in a place where he thought it would receive great honor, no one can really know. Alexander's body was later moved to the city there of Alexandria. Once again, he was brought down to Memphis here in Egypt and eventually moved to Alexandria, where the body of Alexander was visited by some very important individuals that come later in the story, men such as Pompey, Julius Caesar, and Augustus. In fact, Caligula, that horrible Roman emperor Caligula, he went down and pilfered the breastplate of Alexander the Great so that he could wear it in his own battles. When the death of Alexander occurred, the generals looked at themselves as being protectors of the empire to watch over it while Alexander's young child grew, and there was debate whether his half-brother Philip should take over, as I mentioned, was somewhat retarded, or wait for the child. And they appointed a man by the name of Perdiccas, who was a longtime intimate of Alexander. He was made guardian of the two heirs, which essentially made him ruler over the Grecian empire. As time progressed, we see where the empire was divided up amongst four generals. We've got three of them here. You've got the Ptolemies here in Egypt, this area here in the green. The Seleucids had what we call the Syrian Empire. And then this yellow here is referring to, let me get the name here, it just left me, Antipater, who ruled over Macedonia and Greece. And Antigonus at the beginning, one of the major generals, Antigonus, was ruling here in Asia Minor. Now, as time progresses, Perdiccas is assassinated. Around 321 BC, the other generals begin to think, well, Perdiccas has got just a little bit too much power. He's going to take over as emperor. He's not just waiting for the son of Alexander to take over, but he's going to take over power himself. He's assassinated, and Antipater, who was ruling there in Macedonian Greece, that's the yellow area, he took over until he was assassinated in 318 BC, and his son Cassander took over. Olympias, and this is where it really begins to look like a really bad soap opera. Olympias, remember, she's the mother of Alexander. She has Philip, her illegitimate son from her husband and another woman, has him put to death along with his wife Eurydice. And then Cassander drowns Olympias and goes ahead and sweeps the board by drowning Alexander's wife Roxana and his young child, who was also named Alexander. It just takes 15 years, and all of Alexander's family is dead. Within 15 years of his death, there is no heir to the throne. And these four generals, who by this time you're narrowed down to just the three, these generals decide, who are we protecting this empire for? It's time to take what we want and to rule over it. Now in the beginning, Seleucid, he worked underneath Seleucus Nicator, he worked underneath Ptolemy, was over the navies of Ptolemy and everything, but as time progressed and they began to divide these things up, you find these three men that are ruling over these areas. You've got Ptolemy Soter, who's down here in Egypt, Seleucus Nicator there in the Syrian Empire, and Antigonus, Antiochus Gonatas is there over Macedon, and Greece is a semi-independent area. Now we're going to look just real quickly at the Antigonids that are ruling up here. But as you can see, as we look at these things, this empire really has nothing to do with the Jews. In fact, after a brief period of time, it really does not have any bearing at all. It's just a small blip on world history. It's really these two empires that we're going to be looking at in a little bit more detail as the lessons continue, because they are the ones that are dealing primarily with the Jews. Remember, the Jews are caught right there in the middle of the Syrian Empire and the Ptolemy rulers of Egypt. The Antigonids, of course, we noted Cassander's took over after his father, and he had a major rival there in Asia Minor, which was not Lysimachus, but another general named Antigonus Monoptimus, which means simply Antigonus the One-Eye. And Alexander had made him a satrap of Phrygia, that's this area here in the middle of Asia Minor. He had been made a satrap, a ruler there in that area, and he had dreams of ruling the entire empire. Around 312 BC, he had increased from just being there in Phrygia to controlling all of Asia Minor. And he desired to go further. He and his son, Demetrius Polyxeus, invaded down into Egypt in an effort to add to his domain and defeated Ptolemy Lagus and Seleucus at Gaza. Later, they took Macedonia, which is that area there in the yellow. And it was there that they were defeated by Cassander, and Antigonus was killed. The other generals essentially came together to fight against this individual. After the death of Antigonus, Demetrius was driven out of Macedonia by Lysimachus and Pyrrhus into Asia Minor, where he was captured by Seleucus and died in prison. His son, Antigonus Gonatas, recaptured Macedonia and reigned as king until his death, and his descendants continued to reign there in this area until around 168 BC, when the Romans divided the kingdom of Macedonia into four republics. But once again, when we look at these things, we can see that the Antigonid Empire there, this little small area, which they had spread down into Egypt and had taken over all of this area, they really have no effect there on the Jews. It's the Syrian Empire and the Egyptian Empire that have the effect. And it's just like the modern day world that we look at today. You see the Middle East is right there in the midst of everything. All these battles have been taking place. And so every time the Seleucids would come against the Ptolemies or the Ptolemies against the Seleucids, well, who do you reckon got caught right there in the middle? Battle after battle was fought in and around the area of Judea. They really caught the brunt. They weren't really anything more than a buffer zone. Each wanted that particular piece of property to have as a buffer zone to keep the other at bay. Seleucus Nicator, the ruler of the Syrian Empire, that pinkish color empire there, really was able to do the most at conquering a large area and trying to get as much of the Grecian Empire as possible within his reign. He was able to conquer all of this area that had been conquered by Alexander to keep that within his reign. But it didn't take very long. You look at the size of that and the division and the fights that are going on from the death of Alexander on into around 301 BC when they're just fighting once with each other and everything, and we see where he begins to lose off some of these empires, Parthia being one of them that fell by the wayside, along with some of the other. He also lost control. In the beginning, he had control of Palestine, this area of Judea, and it didn't take very long, and Ptolemy of Egypt took that from him, and we'll look at that in just a few moments. The Seleucid kings carried on Alexander's desire to build model Greek cities, the desire to spread these things, this Greek way of life, into these foreign lands. He built Seleucia Trachiatis at the mouth of the Kalakadnos River on the coast of Cilicia, there as his capital city. He also built Seleucia Perea, which is at the mouth of the Orontes River in Syria. And this, you can see that river there coming down, that's Antioch there. And this is where the Apostle Paul began each of his journeys there in Antioch. And in the first one, he leaves there from the seaport there of Seleucia. He named Antioch after his father Antiochus. On the Tigris River, he built Seleucia Opus as a rival capital city to Babylon, and over time it reached over 500,000 population, and the capital of Babylon was gradually deserted. He also built the city of Laodicea in Asia Minor and named it for his mother Laodice. He built Apamea, south of Hamath on the Orontes, and named it for one of his wives. In fact, he built seven cities, which he named for himself, five for his mother, and 16 for his father. This was the idea of Alexander the Great. This was the idea, to build these Grecian cities and model them after the Greek cities. And at the centerpiece of most of the Grecian cities
was the gymnasium and the various schools of thought. The gymnasium was a place where the Greek way of life, you came together and you exercised in the Greek way. You exercised in the nude, much like many of our gyms today. Only they wear more clothes in the gyms today than they did there in the Greek period. Now the problem with this is we see all this Greek way of life, it begins to interfere with the Jews. And you kind of have a path to choose. Do I keep my Jewish heritage? Or do I kind of follow along with the Greek way of life that's taking over with the rulers of the day? And as we look at these things, we see that the majority of those Jews, remember, this was the Babylonian Empire, the Assyrian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. The Jews were spread throughout this empire, throughout the Assyrian, Babylonian, and Medo-Persian. Not all of them came back to Judea, to Jerusalem, when they rebuilt. So they're still living in this area. And the bulk of those who lived within this area began to take the Greek way of life. They began to take on Greek names. They began to follow the various Greek ways. Really, there in the area of Judea, do you have those that desire to keep solely the Jewish way, to continue to be very, very strict on their keeping of the Jewish laws and following after the Lord? But once again, these cities are being built all over the place. And as he's building these things, and as the empire begins to crumble, once again the area of Parthia falls by the wayside. These others that are on the outlying areas, can you imagine trying to control such a large area with the Parthians being one of the most warlike people? In fact, the Romans tried time and time and time and time and time again to take over the Parthians and were never successful. And it's interesting, when we look at Parthia, we see it mentioned in the Scriptures one time. And that's when Jews came from Parthia there in Acts chapter 2. So these are some of the Jews that show just how far the Jews have been spread and how they were continuing to be under this Greek estate. Now, just to real quick close out the lesson for this evening, and we'll look at the Syrian Empire and the Ptolemies there in Egypt in a little bit more detail, because there's some really interesting things as we look further in the vision that Daniel had there in Daniel chapter 8. You remember the four horns came up from the one horn, and then out of those four horns, one more horn comes up, a smaller horn, and magnifies himself against the King of Kings, against the Lord, against the heavens. Well, that's going to be some of these kings that rise up here during the Grecian empires of the Syrian Empire and the Ptolemies. Now, as I mentioned, when their division was first made, the Seleucids there ruling over the Syrian Empire, they had control of Judea. But remember, I said that Seleucus Nicator was under Ptolemy in the beginning. Was over his navy. And so when Ptolemy said, "I want Judea," Seleucus really couldn't say too much. Now, Ptolemy was an interesting individual and was not near as benevolent as Alexander was. You remember in our lesson last week, when Alexander came down and he destroyed Tyre in the siege that took 7 months, and he came on down, and we talked about the procession of the Jewish high priest and the others that followed behind. The Jewish high priest was in these purple and scarlet robes, and all the others were following behind him in white robes and coming out to meet Alexander the Great. And Alexander came in, and he essentially told the Jews, "All right, you can continue to worship in your temple. You can continue to worship in the way that you want to worship." Well, Ptolemy wasn't exactly that way. Ptolemy discovered, and this is something we can read of in the writings of Josephus, Ptolemy discovered that the Jews observed the Sabbath day and found it rather strange that a people would not do anything on an entire day. And this just really goes to show the change in the Jewish people from the days of the Babylonian Empire and the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember, Malachi was writing to them there at the very end of the Old Testament, saying that they were not keeping the Sabbath. He was rebuking them for not keeping the Sabbath, for not observing the Sabbath laws, for not caring for the priests in the way that they should. And here we find that these Jews that are here in Judea are so devout in their keeping of the Sabbath that even when they're attacked, they continue to keep the Sabbath day. Ptolemy learns of this. And in the writings of Josephus, Josephus quotes Agatharchides' report of this. And it says, "The people known as Jews who inhabit the most strongly fortified of cities, called by the natives Jerusalem, have a custom of abstaining from work every seventh day. On those occasions, they neither bear arms, nor take any agricultural operations in hand, nor engage in any other forms of public service, but pray with outstretched hands in the temples until the evening. Consequently, because the inhabitants, instead of protecting their city, persevered in their folly, Ptolemy, son of Lagus, was allowed to enter with his army. The country was thus given over to a cruel master, and the defect of a practice enjoined by law was exposed. That experience has taught the whole world, except that nation, the lesson not to resort to dreams and traditional fancies about the law until its difficulties are such as to baffle human reason. In other words, they ridiculed the keeping of the Sabbath. They took advantage of the keeping of the Sabbath. And Ptolemy was a very cruel ruler in many ways when he came in there. Alexandria was already laid out by Alexander, but Ptolemy set about making it a great city. He took 100,000 Jews, 100,000 Jews and transported them to Alexandria. Some 3,000 of these he absorbed into his army, laying the foundation for the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy there in Isaiah 19, verses 18 and 19, that an altar would be built in the midst of Egypt, and that five cities would be speaking the language of Canaan, and one to be called the City of Destruction, which in the margin it says Heres or of the Sun. He's obviously referring to the city of On, 5 miles northeast of Cairo, at that time a center for the worship of the sun, and called by the Greeks Heliopolis, or Sun City. And the Jews ended up building a temple there. And there was also a Jewish military colony that had been settled on Elephantine Island in the Nile River near the first cataract opposite Aswan, there in this first area here. And so we see that Ptolemy goes about doing the same thing. And once again, the Jews are upheaved and moved from their land. And so as we look at the empire of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids in the next couple of lessons, we're going to see where this has a direct effect on the Jews. And this direct effect on the Jews and this abuse of their following of God and their keeping of the Sabbath, it becomes somewhat of a recurring theme to the point that we get to the time of the Maccabees, that famous Maccabean period, when they decide, well, we can't keep the Sabbath if we're being attacked. We're going to have to fight. Now, as we look at these things, once again, keep in mind the prophecies that God has given through His prophet Daniel hundreds and hundreds of years prior. The prophecy that was given there in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, four empires that would rise. We've now looked at three of them. The prophecy in Daniel chapter 8, as Daniel received that vision there at the end of the Babylonian Empire, before the Medes and the Persians took over, that vision that he received of the ram and the he-goat, and the notable horn and the four horns that rise up. Well, we're at that part of the four horns that are going to rise up. And in all of these things, we want to keep in mind the words, the warning that was contained in the vision of Nebuchadnezzar, that these things were written in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom He wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men. A lot of times we'll question, why would God use such a horrible person? We look at Nebuchadnezzar and we see the things that he did to the city of Jerusalem. We see the way that he treated the Jewish people. We look at some of the kings of the Medo-Persian Empire and the way that they treated the Jews and the effect that they had upon the world. And well, let's just be the first to say it. The Greeks were not exactly the best of individuals when it came to certain moral issues. But they had what they considered to be a superior way of thinking, a superior way of doing things. But God used each of these individuals, each of these empires, to carry out His plan. It's no surprise that the Grecian language, the Greek language, is one of the most precise languages the world has ever known. With more ways to describe something, more synonyms than, I mean, even the English language is nowhere near in weighing able to, in the being of precise, in knowing exactly what you're saying. And that's the empire that God uses. That's the language that God uses to bring His kingdom, His final revelation into being. As we'll look at the Ptolemies, we'll see that Ptolemy's son, as he increased Alexandria, and he began to build the great library of Alexandria. He learned from the Jews that were living in the area that they had this great ancient literature, and he brought them down and had them to translate it into the Greek language around 280 BC. That's around 280 years before Christ. This is being translated. And interestingly enough, as I pointed out before, this is the translation that's used by Jesus. This Greek language translation of the Old Testament is the one that's used by Jesus, that's used by His apostles. In fact, 6 out of every 7 quotations in the Gospels and the book of Acts are taken from the Septuagint rather than the Hebrew Scriptures. And so we can see that God has got His plan. He's laid it out, and it's following exactly according to the order that God has set. We oftentimes look at them solely from history and go, Alexander was a great man. No, he was a man chosen by God to do a particular job. He fulfilled that job. He fulfilled his prophecy, and other prophecies were made, and they were being fulfilled too. God rules in the nations of man, and we should never, ever forget it. All this time that God is being silent, that the Jews are looking for a word from God and they can't find anything, God's plan is working. It's being carried out. And we can learn, if nothing else, God has a plan today. He's made one final prophecy to us, hasn't He? He's told us that there's going to be a day of judgment. He's told us that His Son is going to come. And when His Son comes, that's the end of the world, that we are to be ready. And as we look at the authors of the New Testament, we see that they were looking for that day in their day and time, over 1900 years ago. They were waiting patiently, some of them almost impatiently, for the day of the Lord. We need to be prepared. We need to be looking at the times, at the seasons that we're living in. There's no way to know when the Lord is coming, so the best thing to do is to be prepared today. And so we give you that opportunity this evening to become a part of the kingdom of God by confessing your belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, repenting of your sins, being buried in baptism, arising a new creature. Perhaps you've obeyed the gospel. You've become a part of the kingdom of the Lord, but like the Jews of old, you've fallen away, and perhaps He's brought some hard times on you. Perhaps life has gotten a little difficult on you because you're not serving the Lord. Then now is your time to be like those Jews and to turn to Him. As we read in the book of Hosea, did you note all those things about Ephraim and Samaria? That was the northern kingdom of Israel. And the prophecy was being made, turn to Me or suffer the consequences. They refused to turn to the Lord, and they suffered the consequences greatly. The nation of Israel was never again a nation. And you, if you refuse to repent and to return to the Lord, will never again be a child of God. And you will never see the beautiful shores of heaven. But the opportunity is given to you this night to make whatever correction is necessary as we stand and as we stand.